We believe that we need to do bad things in order to use dodgy methods and test the ethical and legal boundaries in order for the greater public good. To serve you, we must do naughty things. So down the years, I became aware that Germans got up to all sorts of tricks. Dressing up in white coats to get into hospital wards, offering public officials money, blagging information from bureaucrats in phone calls. That's pretending to be someone you're not. You know, you ring up and say to a policeman, "Hi, it's Constable Greenslade here. I'm wondering if you'd just tell me the CRO on this." I've never done that, of course. Photographers who trespassed regularly to get stories, sub-editors who bent quotes, and journalists who really routinely invaded privacy or grief, and of course editors who encouraged it, editors who in fact make it happen. The important thing about newspapers is they're not democracies. The world of the publisher is law, but in the newsroom, the world of the editor is law. So it's common to hear tabloid reporters say, you know, in the pubs that they used to go to, you're only as good as your next byline. So it's obvious that getting that byline, getting the story, is of paramount importance to one's career. You know, and that career includes a pretty good income, perks and privileges, all that journalism provides. And there's also a culture of bullying in newsrooms. News executives that were considered good were like sergeant majors. So satisfying an editor's whim or prejudice was seen as an invaluable aid to survival and possible promotion. So, but the most appreciated reporters in my lifetime in popular papers were those who got up to strange things and stunts, if you like, in order to get stories. They were known not as good reporters. The real key phrase was, he's a great operator. A great operator. And this goes back right to the 1950s, not a new thing. Now, it's also not an exaggeration to say that the News of the World was noted at least from the early 60s for its willingness to take greater risks than anyone else to obtain stories, mainly because its agenda, its news agenda, was largely more sleazy than anyone else's, and it therefore also tended to get involved with people who were that much more secretive. So its reporters were encouraged, in a way, to pioneer the use of controversial methods. It was the first paper to really make a habit of using subterfuge, covert taping, covert filming. And its staff even liked to boast about their ingenuity. One of its senior investigative reporters liked to tell, he's a great pub raconteur, this guy, he liked to tell how he planted a microphone in the nose of a teddy bear on the bed of a prostitute in order to expose the sexual dalliances of a conservative minister. And a News of the World editor once boasted, once told me the story, you'll never guess what happened. We had this guy set up in a hotel room and we had a camera hidden away, and just as he was taking his clothes off, he threw his jacket and he went over our camera lens. It wasn't seen as a serious matter, it was just part of how the News of the World went about its business. And with technological advancement, cameras got smaller and recording devices became more reliable, and the arrival of the internet allowed them also to do amazing things. Apart from the subterfuge, they would create fake websites. So this man would turn up to and you think, we'd better check on his bona fides, and this is his line, and there was a fake website. And indeed, on a programme only the other night on Channel 4, the man who constructed that website, who's now turned against Mazen Mahmoud, revealed that he was the one who set those up. This gave this technological advance and this greater aggression and this great need for stories of the News of the World ever more intrusive led to a plethora of what are called sting operations under the famous investigations editor Mazen Mahmoud, who loves to call himself the fake sheikh. And his controversial entrapments of a whole raft of celebrities and sportsmen and members of the royal family were not seen as anything other than brilliant journalism. He won several Reporter of the Year and Journalist of the Year awards. And he used those, it's true to say, he used those same skills to expose illegal migrants, people traffickers, drug dealers, and so on. But it was always the case of he was willing, and the paper was willing, to use what we think is the tool or the methods of last resort as a method of first resort. And then came hacking. And then came hacking after this long 40 or 50 year period of pretty bad misbehaviour by journalists. And seen in the context then of the escalating misconduct, it can seem then be seen as a natural development rather than a kind of one-off. It wasn't an aberration. Now, papers want you to feel that. If you see the editor of the Daily Mail, Paul Dacre, giving evidence at Leveson, he seemed to be suggesting, oh, that's all the news of the world, we're nothing like that. It's just an aberration, it's just something you can tuck away, not a matter of genuine concern. Anyway, the odd thing is that when David Cameron panicked and set up the Leveson Inquiry, the one thing that the Leveson Inquiry couldn't do was actually look at hacking, because it couldn't interfere with the police investigations, so it's in fact cast its net much wider and looked at the wider standards and ethics and practices of the press. But that's not to say that the inquiry over this last 9 months has been worthless. My hat, in fact, is off to Lord Justice Leveson. I'm an admirer of him and his team. In 9 months, they've taken a mixture of written or oral evidence from 650 witnesses. And he's writing his report, as you rightly say, and he'll be presenting that report in October. You might think he's a faster writer than Lord Savile. Anyway, along with those witnesses were a number of celebrities like Sienna Miller, Hugh Grant and Charlotte Church, told of intrusions into their privacy, pretty disregarded by the public. They're only celebrities and so on. J.K. Rowling, I don't think I would call her a celebrity, but she spoke of being under perpetual media siege. But the same charges made against the press had greater effect, greater emotional effect, greater public recognition when they came from people like Kate and Jerry McCann, who you will recall, whose three-year-old daughter Madeline disappeared. They came with greater effect when Chris Jeffries, a nice, intelligent man who just happened to be the landlord of a murdered woman, was traduced in the press after he was arrested, and by the way, probably wrongfully arrested. I hope he wins his case there. Along the way, there were those set-piece moments, because Murdoch, having already made a startling appearance at in front of the Commons Select Committee, then made a pretty weird appearance in front of the Leveson Inquiry too, and there was, we saw Rebecca Brooks talking about everything except hacking, and we saw Andy Coulson, and most amazingly, David Cameron himself. So here's a man who sets up an inquiry in order to kick it into the long grass, and suddenly he finds that Lord Justice Leveson and his counsel are cross-questioning him about his relationship with Rupert Murdoch, about going out riding with Rebecca Brooks, enjoying country suppers with her, and sending her text messages signed LOL, because he didn't realise that LOL didn't mean lots of love. But the major revelation, aside from those relationships between senior politicians and the Murdochs, were about those close, that triangle of close relationships. News of the World, editors and staff, wining and dining with senior metropolitan policemen. News of the World, editors and publishers, meeting for weekend retreats with the Prime Minister and senior ministers, are all sending each other text messages. And so News of the World alone, Prime Minister, Metropolitan Police. And yet, of course, I don't believe in conspiracy theories. I think this is what we might call circumstance. But the circumstance was, and you'd have to say this is suspicious, why did the police never investigate phone hacking in the first place? Their excuse in front of Leveson was, oh, we were the terrorist branch and we were dealing with terrorism at the time. You mean the police are not big enough to be able to say, well, we'll give that to a little group and see where that goes? No, in fact, they kept appearing in front of the cameras and saying, there is no evidence. Evidence that's now led to the arrest of 73 people. At the centre of all this, I'm nearly coming to a conclusion. At the centre of all this is Murdoch himself, enjoying the benefits of what politicians seeking to support the support of his newspapers one. He said in front of the inquiry, I don't go to them. They come to me. Well, I actually believe that's probably true in a sense. But I also think he benefits from them coming to him, and he sometimes does seek them out. Otherwise, why would he go in the back door of number 10 Downing Street rather than the front? He said, if you say Rupert Murdoch knew nothing about hacking, I happen to be one of those. Some of my Guardian colleagues think I'm really naive. I happen to be one of those who believes that Rupert Murdoch knew nothing about hacking. I happen to believe that he set the climate in which hacking could occur. And if you're the head of a company, in charge of a publicly quoted company, it is your responsibility to have in place rules of governance which would prevent that occurring. Worse, though, for Murdoch, is that when evidence was clearly being published week by week by Nick Davis in The Guardian, and to an extent in The Independent, and very importantly in the News of the World, for him then to say, I still believe in the rogue reporter defence, was of course utterly, utterly culpable on his part. At that point, he must have realised there was something nasty in the woodshed. Now, he said in front of Leveson, I was badly let down by my executives. They didn't tell me what was going on. And immediately, of course, one of those executives, a man of 50 years standing and close friendship with Murdoch, he was one of those who resigned, Les Hinton. But for him, with his street nous, because he does have it, not to at that point have said, we now need to do something about this, and instead allowed what is and has to be seen as a massive cover-up. Read the judgments of Mr. Justice Voss in many of the cases of hacking, and he will tell you, News International indulged in what was clearly a cover-up. Emails were deleted. There were attempts to do. I can't go into any of the details, of course, because that forms part of the case in some of these cases. But the important thing is that he set the corporate agenda. So it takes me just to a conclusion here. The danger, and I don't know if Leveson will address this, there are twin dangers coming from Leveson. One danger is that he will have nothing to say about the need for greater plurality in the press. The truth is, Murdoch became so all-powerful in the British media environment. That's why the Prime Minister paid court to him. That's why the Metropolitan Police didn't move against him. Because here was a man who controlled so much of the media landscape. That danger would be that Leveson doesn't mention that at all. But the main danger from Leveson, of course, is that he will say now, well, the situation now is that we need to curb the press. We need to curb it because of what's happened. And that he might, in instituting a new kind of press regulation, perhaps make that too harsh and might indeed threaten the necessary press freedom. The main cause of that is Murdoch. It's Murdoch who's brought this down on all of us, that threat, by not having a rogue reporter, but having a rogue group of reporters, having a rogue newspaper, and having a rogue company. That's the real disaster. And I shall leave it there for a second. Thank you.
Thanks, Roy. Appreciate it. Jim Gibney always has a question. I'm going to open this to the floor. Oh, the man beside just got in first, and then we'll take the man in front. Jim, you'll be out. Oh, we've got loads of questions. Roy, thank you. That was great.
Yeah.
Fire.
I'm Paul. I'm quite a good life. I was in correspondence with you about various things.
I am.
I'm a journalist myself. And you mentioned Ian Hirst there, and the fact that Ian Hirst was hacked. But I think if you look at Jane Winston's complaint for the British Irish Rights Watch to Leveson, what she's saying, if I'm reading her evidence correctly, is that her whole group of clients were hacked, not just Ian Hirst. And where did that hacking material go? It went to Dublin, went to Alex Manchester, Dublin.
I know the point you're making. Yeah.
Can I make this point?
Yeah.
Why has there been no inquiry to the fact that Marmchak, who was not really an editor, his official title, as far as I understand it, was senior editor of News International. It wasn't just about the news of the world. You use the phrase local newspaper. I actually think it's a local corporation. And my link question to that is, how much what was Marmchak's role in your view in Dublin for 10 years, taking that material, and then how much of a political motivation was there in, for example, in the context of Jamie Winter's complaint?
Okay, this is a fair question, but I can't give you, Paul, a really fair answer. In the sense that Marmchak is definitely under investigation. Alex Marmchak supposedly ran the Dublin office of the News of the World, and before that was a junior executive on the News of the World for many years. Paul raises, you know, all sorts of important things that I can't really speak about. I can speak to you privately afterwards, Paul, you know that, but Marmchak has been arrested at some stage, and he's technically on police bail. He could face a charge. And if I was to say what I think about his role, I would, especially since this has been recorded and we're in public.
Okay.
I just don't think I can.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
But what you say raises really important points. Although I'm always wary of conspiracy theories.
Okay, we'll take the next question. Maybe you could have a chat afterwards. We'll take the next question. The gentleman in the front.
Oh yeah. Yep. Can I ask you? You ended up by talking about Murdoch, and many of us that have followed these events over the last couple of years and listened to what you said would have concluded that Murdoch was finished, that he was largely discredited, that he could never operate in the same way as he's operated over the last 20 years. And those of us who remember Watling 20 years ago would regard this as being just the way in which things have ended. However, over the summer we noticed the way in which Boris Johnson and him have been snoozling up together. Does Boris Johnson think that in fact Murdoch is not finished, that there's still a role for him? Because of course, as we know, Boris Johnson aspires to be the successor of Cameron.
Yeah, and in fact, he's not the only person to cozy up to Murdoch. Most importantly, the Education Minister, Michael Gove, is in constant contact with Murdoch because Murdoch's great interest in life is education, being used to learn. And it is clear that he could make a comeback. My real feeling is that he is a busted flush, politically speaking, in Britain. That he couldn't possibly do. I mean, you've got to see, Boris Johnson is a maverick character, and it was a maverick decision to invite him to invite Murdoch to the Olympics, and I don't think it means more than that. I do genuinely believe he couldn't have the kind of influence, that he's had previously. It just wouldn't be possible.
Okay, question at the back. Somebody had their hand up at the back, and then we'll go to the right wingers. Somebody had their hand up at the back? No? No? Oh, no, here we are on the right. Lovely.
Who should have resigned?
Jeremy Hunt.
Yeah, I called for it. I mean, Jeremy Hunt is the Minister of State for Media. Just to fill you in on the background to that, he was responsible for giving a decision on whether Murdoch's bid for BSkyB should go ahead or not. This, by the way, should never be a political decision, but that's the nature of the beast. It was in his gift as to whether he referred it or whether he allowed it to go through. And that was days away from happening. And we do know that he was going to nod it through. It was days away from happening when the great drama of last July broke, preventing it from going ahead. And then we discovered, we didn't know until the Leveson Inquiry, it's another example of how good the Leveson Inquiry is, that there had been hundreds of emails between the private advisor to Jeremy Hunt on one hand and the PR acting for News Corporation on the other, all related entirely to the BSkyB bid. And at that point, the special advisor resigned. In other words, the monkey took the hit for the organ grinder. And of course, I called for Jeremy Hunt's resignation, who, by the way, I had pretty good relations with prior to that, but I called for his resignation on the understanding that a minister must take responsibility for what his special advisor does, and it beggared belief to think that the special advisor was not advising his minister on what the PR at News International was saying to him in relation to the bid. Now, of course, there was no proof of that, and that's one of the reasons he got away with it. And he also gave a pretty good account of himself in front of Leveson. But it's extraordinary when you think about it that within 10 minutes of standing up from the Leveson inquiry, David Cameron announced, "I will not serve as minister." So that's extraordinary that he gave him that much backing. But it is an example of the grotesque embarrassment that exists at the heart of government over Murdoch. And I can't imagine, that's one of the reasons I can't imagine him making a comeback. It's clear that Labour, in the form of Ed Miliband, are never going to go anywhere near Murdoch. They've made such a song and dance about this, and some of their leading MPs have been, Tom Watson, particularly Chris Bryant, have been making all the running in Parliament on this affair. What are they called? Lib Dems. Lib Dems. It's hard to remember. It's definitely Lib Dems would never go to Murdoch. And Cameron wouldn't do anything, I think, that would compromise him with the possibility of losing some votes. And anyway, will he win the next election? I think Murdoch is... it would never happen. And Hunt should have gone, and it will be a running sore. When Coulson goes to trial on perjury, when Coulson goes to trial on unlawful interception of communications, every time he comes up, every time his name is mentioned, in brackets it will say, the former director of communications for Downing Street. It will constantly remind people of the bad judgment of the Prime Minister. That's what will happen. Are you going to have a supplementary question? My reading, that's an interesting, my reading of the situation is that Cameron is not going to fire him. That's my reading of the situation. But it'll be Millen-like Knight of the Long Knives if he does get rid of him, because he's shown such amazing passion for him in public. Again, that will hurt him by being vindictive, and Hunt would be dangerous on the backbenches anyway.
It's coming up to two. If people have to go, feel free. But we have a couple more questions, at least. Jim and then Kevin. Irish News columnist, Jim Gibney.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you very much for a very interesting presentation, and quite, I thought, kind of alarming. You know, you try to kind of follow this story, and it's so complex at times.
Yes.
To kind of get lost in the overwhelming detail that's coming out. But I just want to get a general sense of the impact on the media, your sense of the impact on the media of this hacking scandal. I was at a meeting here, another event, Fela, Human Rights and Journalism, just last week, and there was three journalists there, and they were speaking about their jobs as individual journalists, trying to highlight in society inequalities, injustices, and basically trying to be a watchdog for people who are a voice for the voiceless, so to speak. And they're in the mainstream media. And they were saying about the crisis the industry is in, the pressures the industry is under due to this monopolization of the media, the centralization of the media. I thought it was interesting that you made reference to 20 huge kind of newspapers based in London. Essentially what I'm trying to get at is the media, because it plays such a big part of our lives, is the media irrevocably gone in terms of its quality, in terms of its role, the local newspapers, the role that they play in people's local lives. You know, what impact is this having on the quality of journalism that people really need? Because they, although they're the fourth estate, they're an essential part of society now.
Yeah, it's a fantastically big question, Jim, but let me try and see through it. Firstly, in terms of the national press, There is too small a level of plurality. The oligopoly that control it are only about five people, really, which is, I think, does have its own dangers. However, it's very important to remember that the reason we know about hacking is because one newspaper did get into it, and a second newspaper, The Independent, picked it up. It's fair to say that in order to preserve its status and aware that it was failing in terms of trust with its readers, that the Times, ever since July last year, has done its level best to report quite fairly. I noticed the other day it reported in very straightforward fashion on the latest developments, and the media columnist, the media reporter there, Ben Webster, has really, I think, improved it. The Daily Telegraph got involved in the end. I think there is a crisis of trust in terms of popular newspapers, but I think that crisis of trust has long been there. And the fact that they're popular newspapers and that people still buy them is indicative of that. But on one occasion, some years ago, I did a BBC documentary about what people think of their papers. So I stood outside a news agency in Islington, North London, and as people went in and picked up The Sun or picked up a tabloid, I would say to them, "Why are you reading that?" And they would say, "Because I like it." And I'd say, "What is it about you like it?" And they'd then tell me whether it was The Stars, The News, The Sport or whatever. And then I'd say, "But don't you realise a lot of what appears in that paper is probably untrue?" "Oh," they said, now I'm doing a collective they now, but the general answer was, "But we know what's untrue and what's true. We can tell the difference." But these newspapers shape people's lives. They are the only information they have. So if I was, for instance, to say to them, "Why is there a conflict in the north of Ireland?" they would tell me, "It's because Catholics hate Protestants and Protestants hate Catholics." That was the level of information they were getting in those newspapers. That's just a tiny example of the way in which people are unaware. They think they know what the truth is, but they're unaware. Anyway, we know from the rumours that happen from these newspapers. So there is that crisis of trust, in my view, has always been there. If you look, and I'll just quickly do the local press, I am really concerned that we lose our local press. I'm really keen that we see lots of startups. I like all the interesting blogs that have been started in all sorts of places, new attention to hyper-local journalism. But it's in the end, and that about economics. These newspapers have lost their advertising, classified as migrated to the net. Display advertising is in a bad way because of the recession, and we think the recession is going to last for quite a time. Most of them are highly indebted. Most of them have terrific problems with funding their pension funds. And so we have to think, if we really want a local press because we think it's vital to democracy, can we find a new way of funding it? And I think that commercial publishers don't want to know about that because they want to go on squeezing and squeezing, cost-cutting, two reporters to cover an area that 10 used to do, closing offices, not putting people on the streets, reducing, creating templates for pages, centres of subbing 50 miles away, sometimes in France. Yeah. In Australia, newspapers are now subbed in New Zealand. If you do that, you reduce quality, you reduce the interest of the people, and in my view, they're only doing that to continue making profits. They're managing decline in order to continue making profits. What we the people, have to think about is whether or not we should be saying to the commercial publishers, "We no longer trust you, we need to find a new way of funding." And we might even think about funding local papers like the BBC or something.